This is Keith Scott Allen of Odeco.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by JetBrains. The new ReSharper 6 from JetBrains has been available for early access for a while, but it was recently reinforced with support for Razor syntax. Also providing support for JavaScript and CSS, ReSharper 6 is destined to make Visual Studio a much better development environment. If you're using ASP.NET MVC 3 and want to use ReSharper 6 for Razor coding assistance, try early builds of the productivity tool at jetbrains.net/ReSharper.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on Wednesday, January 26th. Tonight, we're talking to repeat guest Brad Wilson. He was on the show once before with Scott Densmore in December 2009 talking about iPhone development. Brad's a software developer at Microsoft working on the ASP.NET team, and he previously worked on the CodePlex and Patterns and Practices teams. He is an active contributor on several open source projects, XUnit.NET, Object Builder, and on and on. So, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, where should we start? Do you want to start with the MVC 3 stuff? Do you want to talk about...
Sure, yeah. We just shipped MVC 3, about a week and a half ago. So, I'm sure there's lots of questions.
And a lot of those questions are answered. You had a huge list of blog posts. I think your post series is still kind of the definitive source of information about service location.
Yeah, I've actually, I got a lot of positive feedback on that. And I also got a little bit of negative feedback saying, why did you write that as blog posts? Why didn't you put it in the documentation on MSDN? Oops. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, but when you wrote it, this was way back in the beta time frame, right? It was a while.
It was actually the first four posts were beta because we shipped a little bit in beta and then we did a bunch more for the release candidate. So then I added 7 more posts. I know 11 posts sounds completely insane. I know.
So there's a difference in terminology between service location, dependency injection, and inversion of control. Can you explain how you talk about them differently? Like I notice in this whole series, you always call, you talk about service location, and that's the feature in MVC. That's kind of the way dependency injection is implemented. Is that the right way to think about it?
It's interesting. I actually got a lot of negative feedback for using the term service locator too, because some people in the dependency injection community consider service location to be an anti-pattern, but I will get to that in a minute. So the dependency injection support that we put into MVC 3 was really, it is kind of a DI container that you register. The primary purpose is actually to register services that MVC understand. That's actually what we designed it for. It also has an additional benefit that there are certain types of objects that we create repeatedly, the namely being controllers and view pages that people tend to want to do dependency injection on. So we also run those through what we call a dependency resolver. So we chose neither name. We didn't change service locator or dependency injection container. We decided dependency resolver would be sufficiently confusing. So the idea is that you register this with a lightweight wrapper around what is probably a dependency injection container. And we ask you one of two types of questions. We're looking for one thing of this type, or we're looking for many things of this type. And it sort of depends on whether MVC itself is interested in having many types of those services. So things like view engines, we have many of, filter providers, we have many of. But there are things we only can do one of, like the controller factory or the model metadata provider. It's intended to be able to support people who want to do dependency injection, but we didn't go through MVC and sort of plumb dependency injection all throughout MVC because that was just too big a task with not enough payback. If we had done it from the beginning, we might have done it that way. But this was kind of the easiest way for us to get sort of ubiquitous, DI through as much of the system as we could.
Okay. So you mentioned some of the main things that people will use this for then is in the past, you would either wire up dependency injection yourself or you would write your own custom controller factory or that kind of thing. Does this kind of take away the need for doing a custom controller factory in some of those previous ways of extending MVC? Would you see most of that stuff just moving completely to the DI approach?
Yes. So the controller factory in MVC actually pretty much exists just to support dependency injection. That's kind of the reason we put it there.
Okay.
But having this dependency resolver is a way to do dependency injection on your controllers. But interestingly enough, not all containers can sort of build arbitrary types. So some allow you to, like an Inject or Unity, allow you to sort of build on an arbitrary type, but some are not so keen on building arbitrary types. For those guys, you may still want a controller factory, or, you know, if it turns out controller factory was doing two things instead of one, which, you know, I'm a single principle guy, so that was, we ended up splitting out some of that behavior, the object creation behavior, into a thing we call the controller activator. So if you have a DI container, but it, you know, it's not necessarily can't create arbitrary objects, you can give us a controller activator, which is very much like a DI kind of a thing, except you know we're coming to ask for a controller, so you know we're asking for an arbitrary type, not a service. But yeah, the people who were doing controller factories before really, for the most part, did not have to do that anymore. The DI container stuff through service locator is the preferred way now.
So regarding the service location in MVC, a lot of people in MVC 3, a lot of people on different lists and blog posts and everything else have kind of asked why you did what you did instead of using MEF as kind of your injection container, MoBob. And I think that under the hood, are you using Reflection instead of doing any kind of MEFing of stuff in? Or am I just completely full of crap there? which I'm fully able to admit, because I haven't really looked at the MP3 bits or source code yet. So,
no, you're correct. We don't have any tie into MEF at this point in time. We evaluated MEF. The version of MEF that shipped in .NET 4 was designed primarily to support Visual Studio. It's designed, you know, primarily to support this idea of extensibility and plugins. And so it is not really a super tight match with what people think of when they think of a dependency injection container. And its sort of default mode sort of requires a lot more verboseness, you would say, than say doing dependency injection with a Unity or an Inject or anything like that. So we evaluated that, but we've been talking to the MEF team. You know, they're receptive to this idea that people want to use MEF as a dependency injection container. And with MVC3, we shipped NuGet. And I think one of the things we ought to be able to do is to be able to provide, for example, an implementation of the dependency resolver for MVC built against MEF as a NuGet package. And that way, if you want to use MEF, then you should just be able to type, install package mef.mvc3, and you'll get whatever the current build of MEF is, something newer than .NET 4, along with some code that wires it up automatically for you to MVC3. Because I honestly think that, NuGet's really sort of rocketing, and, we should at least consider as a team the kinds of things we can enable through NuGet and not have to wait, to release with MVC4.
Yeah, that was going to kind of be my next question with NuGet. And so MVC3 already is kind of able to ship out of band, and it seems like, being able to couple that with the NuGet package system, you'll be able to ship out of band, even with some features. So if you wanted to update, something like what's a good candidate here? Some of the unobtrusive JavaScript or unobtrusive validation stuff, yeah. Or yeah, even just jQuery.
All right, because we shipped MVC3, it had jQuery 1.4.4 in it. So you want jQuery 1.5, fine, we'll put a NuGet package out there, and it'll put jQuery 1.5 in your project for you. But out of band thing is definitely something we're interested in sort of understanding what the possibilities are. We don't really know what it's going to be yet. MVC ships every, like, our pattern so far has been to ship every year. And, we ship a preview every 3 months. For some people, every year is too fast, but for some people, every year is too slow. And for the people who think every year is too slow, the NuGet's definitely an avenue for releasing stuff. Most anything that we could think of as an add-on to MVC should be releasable through NuGet, and anything that can't quite make it to NuGet, we could do, like maybe in the Visual Studio Gallery for VS 2010.
So does MVC actually have a NuGet package out there on the feed?
There's not a package for MVC. It's kind of a weird situation because, MVC is like a project type and it has associated Visual Studio tooling. So the whole of MVC can't be done as a NuGet package. And so pretty much what all the NuGet packages out there that rely on MVC just kind of put MVC or MVC3 in their name. And people just kind of know they already have to have a project that's an MVC3 project to be able to use that. Again, it's something we've talked about because a few people in the community have asked us for an MVC package, it would be nice if I was, for example, making a class library, not a web app, and that class library was going to reference MVC, like maybe I was writing some helpers for redistribution. And it'd be nice to be able to rely on that package for MVC, because there's not a super convenient way to do that other than you make a new class library and then you have to go to add reference and then search through the 100,000, you know, things for MVC. So it would be a little more convenient with NuGet. But then, of course, that brings up, we basically have a reference to the thing in a GAC already, and then you bring down another copy, and then there's two copies now, and one gets checked into your source tree, and is that really necessary? And so those are things we're sort of batting around in the team. I suspect someone at some point is going to go up to NuGet and actually just make an MVC package anyway, whether we like it or not. So we'd kind of like to maybe have an answer so that we can say, you know, hey, we're thinking about this, and don't do it for these reasons, or, you know, give us a couple of months and we'll sort of come up with an answer.
I was going to say that I noticed jQuery templates are out there as a NuGet package already, which I think is very cool.
Yeah, that seems to be the kind of thing that drops in really easily just as content. So, and then once it's there, it's a tracked package, and so you can do update packages, and you know, if you wanted to keep pulling the latest or whatever, you could, which is neat.
So what would happen if suddenly one day someone puts in 150 jQuery plugins?
What would happen if someone put 150 jQuery plugins? Well, you mean maliciously, or there's just been 150 releases of jQuery?
Yeah, not maliciously, but you know, if you
start, let's say like 15, where you have jQuery 1.3.2, 1.4, 1.4, 1.4.1, 1.4.4, 1.5, and you have minimized, packed, and uncompressed versions of each one of those.
Well, yeah, that's not entirely unreasonable. I think that we're going to just have to evaluate the value of keeping some of the older stuff around long term. So, you know, by the time jQuery 1.5 comes out, do we really need 1.3.2 anymore? I don't know. I think the community will sort of give that feedback.
Yeah, I mean, that would be good. You know, since you can search the repository, it's not such a big deal. But I guess one of the things I'm worried about with NuGet, it's such a wonderful tool because it's so simple, and I hope it, you know, people don't start trying to add categories and tags and I don't know, all sorts of weird
friends.
Stuff to it. Friends. Twitter handles.
Achievements. Yeah.
Installed 50 packages.
Yeah, that seems like everybody I talk to that's not a web developer and I show off NuGet, they're like, well, how do I just add them all? You know, I have to explain that's not what you want to do.
Yeah, especially right now you do list packages from the command line, which I think lists 50 at a time, and that only gets you through the, like, CA.
Yeah.
So, yeah, install them all. That'll take a while.
Yeah, I am. At least there is a field where you can query just for latest. So within a type, you know, if there is, for instance, you know, piles of packages about jQuery, or there are several releases of something, you can just say, I want the latest one. Well, so was there more we should talk about with the DI stuff? I mean, or it's,
I can't think of anything else. It's kind of not really cut and dried, but it's been done.
Yeah.
I think the people that are using MVC will probably understand what the initials DI are for, even if they don't necessarily believe in it, which is something else that I find fascinating. How quickly kind of the community has turned around and become, in general, kind of pro ASP.NET MVC. How now at all the large conventions I see people who were, you know, 8 months ago, a year ago, just bad-mouthing all of us that liked MVC and telling us we were just running after the newest, shiniest thing. And now they're you know, I'm seeing tweets from people like, starting to, you know, present on ASP.NET MVC 3. Any questions? And from these same people who are berating us for, you know, following the new shiny thing. Just kind of amusing to me. That's all I got to say about that.
We kind of talked a little bit about the unobtrusive client validation stuff. That's kind of another big thing. That's something you blogged a lot about. It's pretty cool. It's like, so it's got, instead of the original Microsoft Ajax validation library stuff, there's jQuery validate, and then there's an adapter which writes out like, there's the client and server side stuff based on your attributes, writes out the correct attributes, and then the unobtrusive validator goes through and hooks up the validators for that. Did I mangle that badly enough?
No, you got that pretty right. But actually, the infrastructure behind validation in MVC is kind of interesting, because, you know, there's a few different moving pieces, right? There's the there's a server-side piece that wired up with a validator provider. And the validator provider, we actually shipped several in the box. There's one for iData error info. There's one for the data annotation attributes. And what it does is that stuff sort of abstracts away the actual implementation details of the server-side validation so that we can get all those things to sort of cooperate with one another. But the other thing that it does is when it finds those validation classes, it allows them to participate in client-side validation regardless of what their implementation is. And the way that you do that is you end up returning back these rules, which are basically a rule name and some parameters for the rule and the message for the rule. And then those things are sent down to the client in some form. And we actually have, you know, in MVC 1 and 2, we had this idea that you would send it down as a JSON blob, kind of. Actually, I think this was new in MVC 2, now that I think about it. We would send this down as a JSON blob. And then there was code on the other side that sort of interpreted that JSON blob that was MS Ajax. And again, you know, the JSON blob didn't really know anything about what the intended end implementation was going to be. Just so happened that the one we shipped was, you know, based on MS Ajax and some validation, custom validation code that we wrote. But there's nothing in a JSON that said this is really only usable by MS Ajax. And similarly with the unobtrusive stuff, there's nothing in the unobtrusive stuff that says this is destined for jQuery. It's really just HTML5 data dash attributes that get appended onto your HTML. And it assumes that something sooner or later is going to come along and look at those data dash, val dash, whatever attributes and wire it up to some kind of validation system. Now, again, the one we shipped in the box is jQuery, but if you were really sold on MS Ajax or, you know, you want to use YUI or whatever, you could write something and interpret it as attributes. So the unobtrusive plus jQuery versus unobtrusive plus MS Ajax is really just implementation details from the MVC team. Just happens to be what we ship. You could write them against really any of those things that you wanted to.
Did you see people doing that with, like you mentioned with MVC 2, there was the support for JSON, and it was I always thought that was cool, but I never saw anyone actually using it outside of, you know what I mean, writing their own custom JavaScript against that.
Well, so we shipped in MVC Futures, we shipped a version that consumed that JSON and wired it up to jQuery Validate. It's not nearly as good as the stuff we shipped in MVC 3 because it sort of never really got past prototype and it had a few bugs. But we saw people in the community modifying it and saying, you know, hey, I made these changes and this is how you get this kind of stuff to work. So people were kind of fiddling around with the idea that you could take that JSON and wire it up to jQuery. I think now that we've got jQuery Validate in the box, I think the number of people who are going to fiddle with it are probably pretty low because, you know, what we saw was that people wanted jQuery. And now that we've got jQuery, that, you know, the few outliers, they might write this stuff, but we'll probably never hear about it unless it gets blogged.
Right. So one thing I couldn't help but wondering, I was looking at that, I was thinking, you know, there's a bunch of validation controls for web forms, and there's no reason, like you're saying, this is all pretty decoupled. And so if you had those HTML5 attributes, like if the validation controls, instead of writing out whatever JavaScript, if they wrote out those attributes, and then everything else could still be wired up and do its thing, right? Is that something that, I don't know if there's any value to that. But.
Yeah, you absolutely could do that. The problem you'll run into right away, other than, you know, you basically have to rewrite the validation controls. But, you know, assume that that's the trivial part. What you run into is that feature-wise, the unobtrusive validation bit that we shipped in MVC is missing a couple of features that you would need for web forms. The biggest one is validation groups, because, you know, in web forms, you have one form and multiple buttons, and the way you figure out which button is going to do what on the server side and which fields go with which button is with validation groups. And so you need to be able to mirror that with one form. You'll have basically subforms. So that would be something that you really need to wire in. It's not there. But, you know, if you could ignore some of those differences and really all you cared about was you had one form inside your actual form, then, yeah, it would not be all that difficult to get it to work. Actually, when I wrote the unobtrusive validation stuff, I gave a brown bag to the team saying, you know, hey, this is what I did. And I invited all the devs, not just MVC, but all the ASP.NET devs and testers, and said, you know, this is what we did and this is how it works. And what I actually started out with was Web Matrix, which, you know, at the time was called Plan 9. But, you know, I started out with Web Matrix and here's an input element in HTML. And I'm just going to add data-val equals true and data-val-required equals please type in a value for first name. And then just include the JavaScript. And there's no server-side code involved at all. It's just all client-side code. everybody's like, that's kind of interesting. Why did you choose to do it that way? And then it was kind of an interesting way to approach it because, the code, even though we ship it in MVC, has absolutely nothing to do with MVC. It's get these attributes on your form, call this method, and, away we go.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody at a webcam thing, and they had a question on how they could do some validation, and we ended up just saying, well, he had his own custom template, and he was writing out an input element, and I said, well, just write out that attribute, as part of your, and, we're like, should work, and you tried it out, and it did, and we're like, like you're saying, you could use it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, because, we were thinking about what would it look like if you could use it from within, the new web pages stuff in WebMatrix. And there's no built-in support, but certainly, that's one way you could do it is to just, since you're probably going to just write plain old input tags anyway, is just go ahead and drop those attributes on there and grab that file, and away you go. You got client-side validation.
So I kind of assumed because of the blog post that those were some of the main features you worked on was the dependency injection and the JavaScript-related stuff. Is that accurate, or were you working on a ton of different things and those just happened to be things you posted on?
Those are the big ones that I worked on. And the dependency injection stuff was interesting because I ended up working on, the first half, which is, those first four blog posts, which kind of set the pattern for what we were going to do. And in the second half, another developer came along and picked it up and did the rest and made the improvements. And we sort of sat down and designed what the rest of it was going to do. But then I went off and did the JavaScript stuff while he was doing that. But, there's a lot of new stuff in MVC3 that I actually had absolutely nothing to do with, like Razor, right? The new Razor view engine.
Yep.
And so, the team's actually really small. It's four developers and two testers and a PM and a dev lead. So people are always really surprised by how small the team is.
Yeah.
That's smaller than the Rails core team, I believe. I'm just saying.
Yeah, they're a little farther along than we are, though.
Well, so are there any other, key features? So those are kind of, I don't know. It's always hard. There's like a long bulleted list of just stuff, I guess for me, the things that kind of jump out, like Razor's definitely is changed just how I write my view code. And it's just simpler. And I feel like I'm context switching a lot less. And then there's it's version 3. And so you're starting to get to the place where you've got these advanced features getting baked in, like service location and some other things that, people are running into that they need for larger applications. And then from a developer point of view, NuGet is just kind of revolutionized the way that I'll develop. And some of it's because it's just so painless to just kind of to pull a dependency in, not have to worry about something going wrong or that I'm going to screw up my project too much or take half a day to learn how the developer, set things up. So, those are kind of some of the main things that I look at. And then there's a bunch of other things like HTML.raw. Okay, that's neat. It doesn't really kind of fit in a bucket. It's just kind of a cool thing, Is there any other favorite features or things that you think of that are...
Have they changed the doc type away from XHTML to just HTML5 yet?
We did indeed. In our default templates, we're using HTML5 doc types, by which I'm sure you meant HTML doc types.
Correct. Well, depending on which particular working group you follow, I guess.
Yeah. So, the big features were basically DI, Razor, and unobtrusive. Actually, it's interesting. Most people think of unobtrusive as a validation feature. We also put unobtrusive Ajax in there as well. Because we've always had this concept of you can have a regular form, which does a regular post back, or you can do an Ajax form, after which you can, we have built-in support replacing content, kind of like the update panel in web forms, or you can get a call back when you get the data back. So we actually have unobtrusive support for that as well. There's a lot of little features. We are targeting .NET 4, so we added a bunch of .NET 4 features. We have the remote validator, which, wires up to jQuery, validates remote. We have JSON model binding support, so if you're bringing in a JSON object, you can basically just get that bound directly to your strong C# class automatically if you'd like. Those are kind of the big ones, and of course, tons of little stuff, things people have been asking for, like output caching on partial views and granular control over request validation, lots of tooling changes, like the new project dialog box is extensible, and the new view dialog box is a little bit better. Things like that, sessionless controllers.
You mentioned the dialog box being extensible. How does that work? Like the two things there, there's the project template types and there's the view engines. Is that relatively pretty simple then for somebody else to drop in like a Spark View Engine thing in that drop-down list?
So we have a couple places where we have extensibility for that for view engines. New project is one of them. In MVC2, we shipped two different project templates. It was, you know, MVC2 web application project, which had the default content in it, and then the MVC2 empty web application project, which wasn't entirely empty because it had a bunch of JavaScript and some CSS and whatnot in there. In MVC3, we just have one project type again from Visual Studio, which is MVC3 web app. And that what that does is it brings you to a wizard. That wizard used to just be, would you like unit testing? But the wizard now is, which one of those two flavors would you like? And what view engine do you want? And do you want unit testing? And all three of those things are pluggable. So in that dialog box, you can basically make your own project template. And a project template is associated with a view engine. So we actually ship four project templates, right? Empty and web application against ASPX and Razor. But as it turns out, we ship eight of them because there's C# and VB, right? But you can write your own project template and you could say, this is, you know, an empty project template for Spark or Enamel or whatever, and actually plug that in. And it's, you know, the process is a little involved because it's Visual Studio. So you have to copy the project template into the Visual Studio directory. You have to run Visual Studio and say, hey, there's a new project template type. And then you have to put some stuff in the registry and whatnot. So not really appropriate for a NuGet, unfortunately, but can certainly be done through a V6 package on the Visual Studio gallery. The other place you can plug a view engine in is the AdView dialog. And the AdView dialog now allows you to not only say all the things you used to say, like, I want to make a view, it's partial or not, it's strongly typed or not, but you can also pick a view engine. And you can also pick to an extra checkbox that we added sort of late in MVC3 was, would you like script files or not? So in our default template, the default layout page in Razor or master page in web forms includes jQuery, but that's it. And then in our pages, which have editors on them, we included the ability to say, you know, give us extra scripts. So on the editor pages, that brings in jQuery validate and jQuery validate unobtrusive as well.
Cool. I guess now would be a good time to ask some questions from Twitter. So Jeff Sogolov, who is GSOGOL on Twitter, and so he asks, will we ever see fluent type configurations for filters, validation for controllers and classes?
I've actually written some samples on this. I'd have to look at my blog to see if they ever got into sample code from presentations, but I've written examples of the fluent validation stuff and the fluent model metadata stuff. As for, you know, will we ever have it officially in MVC, I think that the team is kind of divided on whether or not we would put it in core if we were going to do it or put it in MVC futures and whether or not it's something that the community wants. I mean, a lot of what we do is based on what the community tells us. The attribute story actually works pretty well. The fluent or the bytecode strategy, you know, resonates with people who do like dependency injection because they want to have that stuff externally configured to their models, which makes a lot of sense to me. So I totally understand the desire to have that, which is why I prototyped it. I think that was one of the demos I did at TechEd last year. Has not made it into core yet. We're still in the planning phases for MVC4. I'm sure we'll talk about it again like we did in MVC3 and see if it, you know, makes it high enough up the priority list or not.
Are there any other, you know, kind of cool features that are in futures but aren't, you know, haven't made it to core or didn't make it in for MVC3 that, you know, that you find interesting?
Well, one of the things we put in MVC3 RC2, but unfortunately we found a couple of bugs in so that we pulled out, is actually a caching version of the model metadata provider system because it uses reflection and the reflection stuff can be a little bit costly. So we actually made a caching one and it made a pretty dramatic improvement in performance. But unfortunately, because we found the bug, we were not sure we wanted to put it in core. So we ended up moving it into futures. And then, of course, one of the first things we'll do for MVC4 is move it back into core. But I'm pretty sure it's bug free now. So you could grab that and put it into your application and get a nice little performance bump from whenever you're using the expression based model systems, which is how we generate our views by default. So the things with like editor four and whatnot.
A long time ago in MVC years, you blogged about display templates and editor templates. And I was just curious, I actually had a couple questions about those. One is, was there anything new in MVC3 for those?
So we did not add anything new for display and editor templates in MVC3. I actually just had a conversation with a couple of guys today who were asking me about an MVC2 feature request that we didn't get put in MVC3, which was code-based display and editor templates. But You know, we actually heard quite a bit of people were happy with the feature, but not a whole lot of new feature requests on it. So we didn't really have much to add in a way. Plus, we ended up with a relatively short schedule for MVC3 compared to the last version. It was like 9 months instead of a year because we wanted to have everything line up with NuGet and WebMatrix and WebPages and MVC. So, you know, that also necessitated cutting some things that I think we probably would have done.
Code-based templates would be kind of cool. And along those lines, I thought I heard at one time that someone was going to publish a little more officially something like you had on your blog, which is if you wanted to tweak one of these templates, here's a starting ASPX file, or here's a starting Razor file to do that.
Yeah, we actually ship that in MVC3 futures. We have it in MVC2 futures as well, but unfortunately the version that's there is only C# ASPX. So I'm working right now at work, actually, on porting the SPX1 to VB, and then porting them both into Razor, and then I think what I'm going to do is release them as NuGet packages.
Oh, cool.
I forget who released it. Somebody just released something, that a command line thing that'll convert ASPX to Razor after I'd already converted everything I was working on manually.
Yeah, that's the guys at Telerik. Actually, one of the guys who worked on that was one of the guys I had lunch with today.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And they found me because I retweeted. You know, of course, I didn't actually get to use the tool, but I thought it was really cool, so I retweeted it. And then like 3 or 4 hours later, he's like, we're going to be in town next week. Why don't we get together for lunch? So that was pretty fun.
Cool. So the way those display and editor templates work right now, that's all they're built out in code. And so then the work that you have to do is actually to say, well, if this was generated from a view, what would that view look like? Is that right?
Right, and I've actually already done it once with the C# ASPX versions. So now it's basically just porting, in that case, the C# to VB.
Ah, right.
And then, you know, I suppose I could run their tool on it, right? And convert the ASPX into Razor.
Cool. We had another question from the same guy that asked before, Jeff Sogolov, and he asked, does the MVC team look to other MVC frameworks to borrow various ideas for a more productive experience?
Well, I would say, you know, all software engineers certainly look for inspiration in lots of places. And for an MVC framework to sort of understand what the other MVC frameworks are doing is a sort of a natural thing. It's hard to say exactly how much of that happens, mostly because I'm the dev and not the PM. So it's kind of a better question for Phil Hack. But we certainly are aware of what's going on out in the space. And we don't always necessarily do what they're doing because, you know, a lot of the things that happen in Rails are, you know, sort of centered around Ruby. And it's not necessarily a one-to-one fit. Like, people have asked us, why don't you have an Active Record implementation? Well, until .NET 4 and dynamic types, Active Record really wasn't a very easy thing to do in .NET, which is, one good answer. But the other is that, you know, people who use .NET use it because of types. And if your Active Record implementation makes up types dynamically, then you're going to lose the benefit of, you know, of IntelliSense and refactoring tools and whatnot that all sort of rely on real strong types. So we don't necessarily always do things that other frameworks do. We want to be sort of careful to pick and choose the ideas that are most appropriate for, you know, the .NET framework.
You know, one other feature in MVC3 that's, I think, just kind of came along for the ride with Razor is the Razor helpers, like the chart and WebGrid and crypto, that sort of stuff. Was there extra work that had to be done, or are they just, because Razor is the view engine, it just works in both places?
That's kind of interesting. So there's actually two sets of helpers, right? There's system web helpers, which when you create a new MVC3 project, you have a reference to that. And that's WebGrid, WebMail, things like that. And then there's also Microsoft web helpers, which you can grab from NuGet, or when you make a new web pages application, you'll have that as a pre-installed NuGet package already. And that's got things like social media, things like Twitter and Facebook, and video embedding and things like that. And a lot of that came around from the web pages project. I mean, they wrote those for them. But we actually were fairly careful in the creation of them to make sure that they were going to work in both web pages and MVC, because, of course, while web pages and MVC share the core ASP.NET runtime, they don't necessarily share the same infrastructure that sits on top of it. CSHTML in a web page is not exactly the same as CSHTML in MVC. You know, in MVC, you have access to view context and controller context and request context and all that stuff that you might not have from the other side. So you can actually write helpers that target both, and all those helpers do. But yeah, it was a conscious effort on the side of web pages, which, you know, originally our code name for that was Project Simplicity. It just turns out that those are some real pain points for a lot of people, even in MVC apps. So having those available is pretty valuable.
Right. Yeah, that's always whenever I'm teaching developers that are familiar with web forms, and, you know, then I'll say, here's MVC, this is great. And they always, one of the first questions, well, where's my grid? How do I do grids? You know, and so, and I could say, well, use jQuery, or, you know, you can use MVC contrib, or there's, you know, a lot of things out there, but it's nice to say, well, you've got, you know, a basic one out of the box.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of the Telerik guys that I had lunch with today, you know, we had the same conversation. Of course, Telerik has all these great stuff for MVC, and you know, one of my questions was, you know, when are we going to see that stuff for web pages? Because, you know, the web grid that ships with MVC and web pages is pretty good for a rudimentary grid, but, you know, it's nothing like, you know, the professional development companies like Telerik have. So It's also cool to be able to take some of this, you know, this high quality, super big functionality stuff like a grid is, you know, you use their grid. It's basically like embedding a little mini Excel into your application.
Any more MVC stuff we should talk about?
I don't think I have anything.
Okay.
Casey. It's definitely not going to solve world peace, the housing and economic crisis.
Okay. So we won't ask that question from Eric Williams.
Yeah, I guess not. Oh, there's the spec flow one is kind of interesting because I guess we haven't really talked about testing.
Cool. Yeah, and then we can kind of transition with that.
Yeah, I was going to say we haven't gotten to xunit.next and trials and tribulations thereof.
Yeah. Well, so
I thought that link there was kind of cool. Sorry to interrupt and derail everything, but I didn't know that Read Write Web had actually linked to our podcast interview with Tim Caswell.
Wow.
And they did. So there we go. That's kind of cool.
That's what you've got to compete with, Brad.
Yeah. Well, what are you gonna do?
Maybe Mary Jo Foley will link to you because you mentioned the code name of Web Matrix.
That's right.
Before it was released.
She'll put you in a PDF.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, you know, most people think that the whole big simplicity thing was Plan 9, but Plan 9 is just the web pages stuff. You know, yeah. Project Simplicity was, you know, all the whole bundle of, you know, the Web Matrix IDE and the SQL Compact and IIS Express, which, you know, I don't think people understand that's a pretty big bundle of awesomeness in all at once.
Yeah, it is huge. Like, just like I had random, you know, bugs. People wanted to test certain things, and it was like, oh, okay, where's my VM? And spin up, you know, my IIS thing and test on. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute, you know, like you can do pretty much everything you need to do as far as with IIS Express as a full IIS.
Well, and not just that, the SQL Compact thing is kind of big too. Because I was pointing people to Orchard CMS a couple of days ago, and I made sure and mentioned to them that you either could, you know, wire it up to MS SQL, or it had a built-in, you know, localized database using SQL Compact Edition.
Yeah,
so you could just install it and drop it and go.
and I mean that's always like SQL Server Express is like. It sounds good, and it, like, when it works well, that's great. And then, but it's doing all this stuff behind the scenes that can, there's a lot of moving parts that can go really wrong.
Yeah, I mean, really, if between IIS Express and granted, it's not quite runnable off of a thumb drive, but SQL Compact and like Web Matrix stuff like that. I mean, if you could get the guys at portableapps.com to really go in and work magic on it, you could almost have a full dev environment that runs off of a flash drive. Just carry that around with you. Well, anyway, there's a pipe dream for you.
But we were about to talk about testing and XUnit and all that business, weren't we?
Testing XUnit.
So XUnit.
So actually, maybe we can tie that to MVC3. Were there any changes in MVC3 that made certain things easier to test or harder to test that you found in the course of development or writing sample code?
Well, I think the dependency injection support makes testing overall easier for people. I mean, I think that's why people who choose dependency injection choose it, is because it dovetails very nicely with testable code. You know, I want to write my controller and have it take a constructor with an interface or an abstract class or whatnot, and not have to have it tied to a specific implementation. But, I mean, even when I use DI, I don't even use DI in my tests. I just use it in my production code. My tests, I'll just, you know, I'll new up a mock directly and then new up the thing that's going to use that mock and pass it into it. And it's interesting that, you know, I made a DI container. Well, I made a DI container framework, really, with Object Builder. And what it taught me was that I don't really need a DI container. I just need things that are DI friendly. And that's what drives me to better looking code.
Some of the unobtrusive JavaScript stuff will kind of make some of your validators easier to test. But honestly, I mean, it's all JavaScript. You just swap stuff in and out. It doesn't really, if you're writing tests around your JavaScript and validators, it doesn't really matter if the JSON's embedded in the page or if it's in attributes. It's all kind of 6 of 1, half dozen the other. Although it may have been a little bit easier when it was just JSON on the page versus attributes, because now you have to kind of go through this, you know, DOM setup and create your kind of fake sandbox DOM if you're going to be writing unit tests around your validators. But
yeah,
there's so many frameworks out there for that. It's not even funny anymore.
Right. There's a nice wrapper for HTML agility pack that uses jQuery selectors, things like that. It seems like it'd be pretty, you know, pretty simple to use that to set it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I show people, you know, how to unit test their JavaScript stuff, I show them QUnit because they're going to be using jQuery anyway. They might as well use QUnit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it has its own little sandbox. By the way, put your HTML over here in this div with this ID, and you can come play with that later. I sort of think that's the answer. I think, you know, long-term, people are going to want to be able to unit test their JavaScript without having to have a browser pop up. There's good and bad things to that. The good thing is it's going to be a lot faster. It's going to be a lot less fragile. You know, it's better for your CI machines and whatnot. But it also runs the risk that, you know, you test it to make sure it works in your little sandbox, but sandbox doesn't actually emulate reality.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, I mean, with that, there are all these nice JavaScript engines. I mean, of course, there have been a lot of them out for a while, but I'm just looking at Jurassic today. It's like that keeps coming along as one of two .NET JavaScript implementations. It seems like something like that you could test, you know, you could do that testing.
Well, and as part of my charter to somehow work Node.js into every podcast, there have been a couple of headless testing frameworks released here recently that use Node.js to allow you to run tests against your JavaScript and, you know, simulate the DOM and whatever else without having to pop up a browser a la Watton or anything like that. So I'm forgetting their names. I know Thomas Fuchs of Scriptaculous released one. And there was one other one, and I can't remember the name right now. We'll link that in the show notes as framework that Scott can't remember, I guess.
Are we ready to talk about XUnit yet?
Wait, Kevin has a question.
Oh, good.
Wait, Kevin has a question.
Oh, sorry, maybe not.
Oh, man.
Kevin?
Yeah, I'm here. Wait.
There's a bet going on whether or not you have a question.
Well, so somebody mentioned SpecFlow in there. But that was not followed up. What was the angle there?
I'm trying to see if he can enumerate kind of what his problems were that he was having running those three things, SpecFlow, Watton, and MVC3 on Win 7 64-bit. I don't know if there was a problem with the bittiness of everything or...
I actually did at the Agile conference this year, I did a tutorial, and the second half of the tutorial was using SpecFlow, Watton, and MVC3 on a Windows 7 x64 box, so it does actually work. But, I mean, there might have been weirdnesses, like, I know you have to run as admin, right? So if you are using the default Win 7 configuration where you're not running elevated, the problem is that Watton sort of demands that you run elevated so that it can run all of the things that it needs to do to automate the browser. But I'm also happy to talk about my love of SpecFlow in general.
Please do.
So when I was approached by the Agile conference last year to come do a tutorial on, I guess, Agile web development with ASP.NET MVC, and at the time it was MVC2, obviously, but I chose to do the first half of the tutorial showing how to do test-driven developments with XUnit.NET, which is the framework that Jim Newkirk and I work on. Jim is, of course, the guy who was responsible for NUnit 2. So I went and gave this tutorial, and the first half was TDD with XUnit.NET, and then the second half was SpecFlow with Watton. And, of course, SpecFlow can target whatever unit testing framework you want, so they actually have built-in support for XUnit.NET. The thing that I had to do was sort of make up Watton web steps, and what I essentially did was stole a lot of the web steps from Cucumber on the Rails side, and just, you know, made Watton versions of those that automated Internet Explorer. But you could do it with any kind of browser automation, like the lightweight test automation framework from ASP.NET, as well as, you know, Watton or whatever else. But I really love SpecFlow, and when I got to show it to people, you know, most people who had never seen Gherkin before, which is the DSL for describing tests, you know, they were a little suspicious of the idea of writing tests in English until they saw what the result was. I mean, they could, it's structured English. So I don't want to make it sound like it's freeform, but, you know, it is kind of the given when then semantics of behavior driven development. So you say, given this starting condition and this starting condition and this starting condition, when I perform this activity, then I should see this and I should see this and I should see this. So if you're familiar with test driven development, you know, that maps really well to William Wake's AAA pattern, arrange, act, and assert. You know, given is your arrange, all the stuff that's necessary just before you do the one thing, which is the thing you're testing. And then when is the one thing you're testing. You usually have, you know, just one when. And then you have then, which is all of your asserts. You know, so given I am on the home page, when I click the login link, then I am sent to the login page. I mean, that's literally how you would write the test in English like that. And then you write these things inside of C#, which are classes that are decorated with attributes like given, when, and then, and they have little regular expressions in them. So it's like the given one would be given when I am on, and then the regular expression inside there says, what is this text going to be? The home page or the login page or whatever. And then you set up this little mapping table so that when someone says given when I'm on the home page, that means they're on slash. And so the Watt and Webb step says, oh, okay, that means they want me to go to the slash page. But what's great about these is you can convince your business person to at least read them, if not to help you write them, because they're in English. And you don't have to teach them the entire strict grammar, but you can say, you know, if you structure sort of the interactions this way, the high level interactions this way, your stories in your agile process, you know, your story cards and Scrum or whatever, as these kind of user stories, which are written like this, then you can directly translate that into code, which is executable, including, by the way, setting, you know, breakpoints in the English and stepping through it, which I think is one of the really cool things. So it's a really great framework. I know there's a couple of Gherkin-based behavior-driven development frameworks out there. You know, I looked at several of them, and Specflow is the only one I saw that supported XUnit.net, and I didn't have to make any customizations to get that to work. So that was kind of the one I chose. But you know, I've always been kind of skeptical of the behavior driven development stuff. But you know, after using Specflow, I'm kind of sold, as you know, for using something like Specflow for your high level specifications, your big integration end to end stories, like, you know, how does a user log into the site, or how does a user search for something, and how the user fills out a form and what should they see. And then after you write those and then they fail, You use TDD to sort of evolve the components underneath that sort of make that story pass. And just like with test-driven development, where you use the test to limit the amount of production code you're writing, you're also using the specifications, you know, your BDD test to say, I can stop implementing things on the website when those things pass. You know, what should be left at that point is basically polishing the UI so that it looks pretty.
Did you ever release those web steps that you put together out anywhere out there?
Agile 2010. So I might not have. Yeah, I must not have, which is really surprising. You know, the interesting thing about the web steps is it actually didn't take me very long to write them. So I should put them in a blog post. In fact, you know, I'll try and track them down and put them in a blog post the next day or two, and that way you can link to them.
Cool. Yeah, one other one that I'd looked at in the past that's a little interesting is Story Queue. And it's not quite, I mean, it's some of the, like, it's, you're still writing your tests in C# code versus a DSL, but it's kind of using fluent chaining syntax to do that. So it's, you know, given and you're that kind of thing. I guess the reason that it seemed kind of interesting was like there's less to install or set up. Although, is Specflow installable via NuGet, or could it be?
Specflow, just the DLL, could be installable via NuGet. They also have Visual Studio integration so that when you open a .feature file, which is sort of what their thing is called, you get a little bit of syntax highlighting and whatnot, and they have some snippets to go along with that.
Cool.
And new project templates and new item templates to go along with it. So that part would have to be, you know, a regular install or a V6 or whatever.
Yeah.
But it all works without that, I think. Although, let me think about that. It wouldn't work without that. Because they actually have a content type with a custom build step that turns the feature file into basically like, you know, when you have, you know, Entity Framework or something that have you like, you know, the EDMX file and then behind it, the C# file is automatically generated.
Oh, right.
they have the same thing where a feature file goes into your project and then it automatically generates C# code as a result.
Is it a T4 template or is it a...
I believe it's all custom code.
Okay.
I don't believe it's T4.
Cool. So you mentioned XUnit. XUnit.net 1.7 beta just shipped January 3rd. One of the big obvious features there is MVC3 support. Is that kind of the main thing there? Or what's exciting about
it? The big new feature for XUnit.net 1.7 beta is MVC3 support. I mean, that's kind of why we shipped it. You know, we have a few bug fixes. We have a few minor features like a new installer UI that's a little better and a couple new assertions. The MS build task can take multiple assemblies. But it's pretty similar to 1.6.1. And in fact, just this past weekend, Jim and I sort of sat down and did the last bits for 1.7 RTM. All I'm waiting to do now is verify that everything works correctly on OS 10 because I'm trying to iron out some of the mono bugs that were reported. And then we'll ship 1.7 RTM.
Yeah, cool. So you mentioned that beforehand. We were talking before the show started, and you mentioned that that's something where you do need to do specific testing on there to for mono issues. Are they just kind of random scattered things, or is there a class of problems that you run into there?
You know, no, it's pretty random stuff. You know, like one example is, you know, failed tests weren't correctly returning the amount of time they took to run. You know, so it's little things like that, like, oops, apparently we did the chain of responsibility in the incorrect order, you know, and it's most of them are, you know, 5 or 10 minute fixes. XUnit.net is, strangely enough, like the only code base I've worked on where I didn't hate it 6 months afterwards, because, you know, most developers are like that. They're like, oh, my God, the 6 month ago me was a total idiot. And I see all kinds of that stuff in code that I wrote in MVC. So it is kind of interesting that XUnit somehow magically has become the one code base that I never hate. And I think I have to give all the credit to Newkirk for that.
Cool. So I forget if we actually asked you about XUnit before. I don't think we did. I mean, it's like you're saying, it's been out coming up on 3 years. It's definitely not new. But how do you, for people that may not have used it before, how do you describe how XUnit compares or fits in with other testing frameworks that are out there?
Sure. As I said before, you know, Jim Newkirk, who's the other guy who works in NUnit, it's basically the two of us. He worked on NUnit 2. So when NUnit 1 came out, basically right after .NET Framework 1 came out, NUnit 1 was like a straight port of JUnit. You could still find code inside of NUnit that said, you know, do this because of this JVM or things like that. I mean, it was very literally the Java code. And then NUnit 2 was sort of the first version of NUnit that It was rewritten from the ground up to sort of, hey, let's try out some of the new features. So like attributes, we think of attributes as a way to say this is a test as a sort of foregone conclusion, but it was really, you know, Jim and I want to say, was it Alexi or Mike 2? I kind of forget which, but it was those guys who basically said, you know, we should use this new attribute feature in .NET as a way to say this is a test instead of, you know, forcing base classes and conventions on test names. So it was an interesting experiment. And in most ways, I think we found that NUnit was very good as a unit testing framework, but there were some mistakes that were made. You know, like the biggest one that comes right to the top of my mind is, you know, expected exception was just a really huge mistake, as it turns out. Mm. You know, we thought it was kind of cool. We would say expected exception type of this and that would mean you didn't have to write any try-catch code, which is actually a cool thing. You don't have to write a lot of try-catch code. But the problem is that, you know, attributes should, in effect, be metadata, not control flow. And expected exception was control flow. It was really part of the test itself. What would then happen is, you know, some line in your test was expected to throw this exception, but, you know, several problems came up. You have, for one, you know, let's say you have expected exception argument null. Who knows which method that you called actually threw argument null? You know, even though Jim and I know about this problem and had counseled people on why, you know, expected exception is dangerous, we found that when we converted from the CodePlex code from NUnit to XUnit, we found like 3 or 4 instances of what I would call false positives. You know, the wrong thing was throwing this exception and it was working out just fine. But the other one was, you know, you came into mocking frameworks where you would sort of set up the expectations up at the front on the mocking framework and then you'd run tests. And then at the very end, you'd say mocks, verify yourself. And the problem is when you use expected exception, the code that you're writing is expected to throw an exception, you don't even think about the fact that Mox Verify yourself never actually got called. So you have no idea whether all the expectations were actually met in the mock. And again, you get a false positive. Yep, found that exception. Great.
Mm.
And then you see the pollution of expected exception with things like, oh, well, what if I want to check the message? And, oh, what if I want to deal with, you know, how do I deal with cleanup after I see this exception? So you've sent all kinds of strange rules. And, you know, another example was in NUnit, you have test setup and test cleanup. You know, you can define these methods that run before and after each test. And they're just regular old methods with this attribute on them. And the problem with that is that, you know, they had behavior that was exactly opposite from kind of what you would expect. So you had to get this weird sort of mental conversion between what you expected and what the test framework was going to give you. So in XUnit, we actually converted that into constructor and dispose. You know, some of the big things we said was, you know, let's scale back from this attribute accept, you know, this attribute obsession of sorts that NUnit had, and certainly MBUnit that came afterwards. Really, I mean, you look at MBUnit, it's got like 60 or 70 attributes. It's just crazy. So we said as few attributes as we can get away with. And then when things exist in the .NET framework, we should prefer to use those things. So all in all, when you use XUnit.NET on first glance, it feels a lot like NUnit or MSTest or MBUnit, because it is, here's a method, here's an attribute on top of it, here's calls to the assert class. But little things sort of, you know, clue you into the differences, and you become used to them and sort of rely on, you know, the benefit of us. There are millions of tests written between the time NUnit came out and the time XUnit came out. You know, there was new versions of the .NET framework, so there's like, you know, support for generics and support for lambda expressions and things like that we just didn't have in the old versions of NUnit. So we got to take advantage of all that stuff.
So I haven't done much with spec flow. The last thing I looked at that was kind of spec related on .NET, I think, was MSpec or machine spec. Is spec flow based on XUnit, or wasn't there some kind of specification, not overlay, but kind of wrapper for XUnit that came out? Or am I thinking of something else?
You're thinking of something else, which actually the one that sort of got legs was called subspec. And the reason it's called subspec is because it was this sort of wild idea of Phil Hacks, who of course works on subtext. And so he wanted to see, it's actually another big difference between XUnit.NET and NUnit and MSTest, is that we have tons of extensibility built into our framework that's really, really easy to use. So we wanted to see, you know, what would it take to make a BDD style specification system on top of XUnit, you know, versus what would it take to build it on top of NUnit. And it turns out it's actually really easy to do because, you know, we had all these extensibility points in mind. Again, you know, 5 years and many, many tests worth of experience to draw from. But not only that, but our framework actually uses our own extensibility point. So we were pretty sure that they did what we wanted them to do. But Machine Spec was a project from Aaron Jensen. And I actually saw it. And again, that, I believe, under the covers could call, you know, assertions from NUnit or XUnit.NET. So it's kind of a testing framework agnostic BDD framework, just like SpecFlow. But in his, he very much relied a lot on lambda expression. So it almost, even though it was C#, it looked a lot like its own testing DSL. But it really was C# at the end of the day. And it's actually a really cool syntax. I liked it a lot. But it's completely unrelated to SpecFlow, to the best of my knowledge.
So have any of you guys used XUnit in production code or in when writing projects, besides Brad?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been kind of my framework of choice for a while. I really got into the whole constructor destructor jazz. And even though I do still use base classes sometimes when I'm doing it, I find that my test code pages end up being a lot cleaner and to me at least easier to read. So, and I never had that with NUnit. It always seemed like no matter how much I put in there, I was always losing the setup teardown and before and after and all that kind of in the attribute noise.
Yeah, we've seen some pretty creative uses of the before and after feature in XUnit.NET, which is this idea that you could write. Now, I know we said, you know, no code and executing code in an attribute, but I'm about to break that rule, right? But the before and after stuff is you can decorate your test method with an attribute, and that attribute has an opportunity to do something just before and just after the test executes. But it's really designed for orthogonal sort of uses, right? You get access to the method info, but that's really it, right? You don't get access to the test class, so you can't inject data or anything like that. It's really for things like one of the examples that we have in our extensions project is you know, set up a transaction in the before and roll it back in the after. So if you're doing any database testing, you know, you can just say, you know, rollback, auto rollback on top of your tests. And we've seen some creative uses of that. And the other one is kind of related to maybe, you know, you're using base classes, but there's a feature in XUnit.net called fixtures. And rather than having fixtures be a class, like a base class you derive from, the idea is that you could write your fixture as a class itself, which has constructor and dispose. And then you can decorate your test class with, I use fixture of that type, right? It's generic, and then get access to it. And then that acts like class-wide setup and cleanup. So like if you were going to have, you know, a database tests again, you could write a fixture which sets up the database and populates it with all your test data. And then you get access to that database through all the tests, right? It's done exactly once. And then once all the tests in that test class run, then it cleans itself up.
Well, there you go.
Cool. So that naturally leads to Swedish death metal.
Naturally.
So, you said that's one of the things that you were happy to talk about. And I would think you were joking, but I follow you on Facebook and I am not, I know that you're not joking. Tell us about.
Oh, no, I'm not joking. I'm a huge Swedish death metal fan.
So how'd you get into Swedish death metal?
Well, so I've been a metalhead for, let's see, I am 38 years old right now. I think the first time I listened to metal, it was probably like, we're talking like a real metal, not like the hair metal, like Poison or Def Leppard or anything like that.
Right.
Cause that was the music from when I grew up. But I think it was probably like the summer between eighth and ninth grade. A friend of mine brought over, you know, some Metallica and Iron Maiden, and I listened to it, and it was bizarre, but, you know, unbelievably awesome. It's just totally drilled right into, you know, my teenage angst. And so I started growing my hair long, which, by the way, is a terrible idea when you have the genetics that I have, because I have curly hair from one parent and wavy hair from the other. So when I grow my hair long, it looks like a white guy fro. But I, you know, I've listened to metal for a long time, and the most odd Swedish death metal moment to me was actually being in Sweden listening to Swedish death metal while I was preparing before my Aura Dev talk.
And they just call it death metal there.
Yeah, I think they just call it music.
Oh, okay.
it's music. Actually, I found Sweden to be completely awesome. Everyone there was so friendly, and it was cold because it was November, cold and windy, but it was really a great place to visit. So I have no idea how angry music comes out of all these very funny people.
Right. Now, wasn't there a band? I think it was called Mayhem, I want to say.
Yeah, Mayhem, the guy killed somebody and went to prison.
And ate him.
Yeah, and ate him.
He like killed the lead singer or something, didn't he?
Yeah, it was this crazy story. It was, I believe that was in Sweden, yeah. But there's certainly, it's a weird thing, right? Sweden is not what you would call a huge country. It's not what you'd necessarily call, you know, a huge cultural influence. In fact, when I was there, almost all the television that was on, other than the local news and some of the local programs, was all, you know, shows in English with subtitles, not even dubbed, from the U.S. I think the only thing they dub when it's in English is the kids' shows. But, you know, everyone there speaks English, like most of Europe, which is very interesting to me as well. How often I've gone to Europe and everybody speaks English and they just look at me and they're like, yeah, I'm not even going to try and speak my native language to you. But, you know, this place where I guess there's a lot of snow, especially up in the north, but there's a city in particular where there's a lot of, you know, death metal bands that come out of. It's Gothenburg, and it's called the Gothenburg Sound. It's the Swedish death metal sound. But there's just a tremendous number of bands that come from Sweden that do death metal. I have no idea why it is. It just happens to be like the thing that everybody does there.
I think it's the darkness, like 8 months of the year, isn't it?
It definitely, you know, I actually liked it. I was in Malmö, which is really close to Denmark. So it wasn't nearly as cold and dark as some of the stuff that was further up north. Like there was snow going on up north while we were there, but we didn't get any. But, you know, I actually liked it a lot. And that, you know, contrary to the story I just told, actually people in Sweden would try and speak Swedish to me first. And I was a little confused about that because people in Denmark never, ever spoke Danish to me. And I asked my mom about it. She's like, oh, you're like 20% Swedish. Like, oh, thanks for that. Apparently I look Swedish enough that people will speak Swedish to me.
Well, maybe if you let your hair grow out and go back to Denmark.
That's right.
They'll try to speak Danish to you.
Yeah, maybe.
Completely unrelated, and I don't know how to transition this. So you've gotten really into fitness over the past 8-ish months or so. Is that about right?
Yeah, I would say I started getting started getting serious about it about April or May of 2010. So yeah, about 8 or 9 months.
I was going to say your prison Brad mugshot looks a lot thinner.
Yeah, that's true. So here's what happened. Scott Densmore, who was my cohort here, you know, the reason we were on the program together, other than we both were .NET guys who also happened to be Mac people as well, he was actually living here at the time, right? So Scott Kuhn comes over to my house, and the three of us sat here, and we had a really great time doing during the Herding Code a year ago. And so it was right after Scott moved here. You know, Scott's always been kind of he likes going to the gym. And so I said, you know, hey, that's a good idea. I'll go to the gym with you. I've been thinking about doing that too. So we went to the gym for a few months, and we started, you know, he started making a little bit better progress than I was. And I, you know, we were talking about it. And he's like, yeah, I've been kind of watching the food I eat and whatnot. And we actually started calorie tracking in July. And then right around September, my friend Jadija Bourgeois, who we actually call him Casper, but apparently a lot of his friends call him Jed. So I'll call him Jed now. Jed had said, you know, hey, I know you and Scott are kind of serious about going to the gym. Scott maybe a little more than me because he was going every day. I was kind of going every other day. And you were thinking about making food changes. You should try this thing that I'm doing. It's called Primal. So I get this book. It's called the Primal Blueprint, and I read it. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, the premise is that, hey, you should behave like your ancestors because genetically speaking, you still are your ancestor. You know, your genetics didn't change in 150 years just because we got mass agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading this book and I'm like, well, all right, I can kind of see that. I'll start making some of these changes, but I'm not really sure that I buy into just do the thing just because genetically that's how we were evolved or, you know, hey, let's be cavemen again because some people call it the caveman diet. But then I read another book, which actually was the book that this guy read when he made his primal book because he makes reference to it. It's a book called Good Calories, Bad Calories. It's a pretty intensely scientific look at what food does to you. I mean, I'd been, you know, it's generous to say I'd been, you know, overweight or very overweight for my entire life, really. Certainly my entire adult life. And it got a lot worse when I became an adult. But I started reading this book and it's talking about how, you know, diabetes is a big problem. Diabetes tends to be related to obesity. You know, a lot of what sort of drives that is blood sugar. And, you know, the type 2 diabetes, which is different than the kind Scott Hanselman has, right? Scott Hanselman has type 1 diabetes, which is you don't make enough insulin. So he's the guy who's constantly monitoring his blood sugar and injecting insulin because he's not making enough or not making any or whatever. Type 2 diabetes, which is used to be called adult onset diabetes until kids started getting it, is the diabetes where you make too much insulin. And pretty much you can sort of narrow that down to you eat too much carbohydrates because, you know, easily digestible carbohydrates like sugars and whatnot cause you to generate too much insulin. Too much insulin causes you to crave more carbohydrates. And it's sort of this downward spiral of weight gain because, you know, there's people will say, this makes you fat, this makes you fat, this makes you fat. Yeah, you know, it can be genetics, it can be this. You know, what I found for me, and I think probably true for a lot of people, is that it's really, you know, it's the sugar, it's the carbohydrates that make you overweight. It's the insulin, the reaction of the insulin, you know, getting that sugar and storing it away as fat. That it's not really the fat, you know, it's not the butter, it's not the bacon, it's not the beef, but it's the pasta and the rice and the bread. And the funny thing is, you know, 100 years ago, it wasn't really a question. People knew that sugar and bread and pasta made you overweight. I mean, my mom, that's the way she grew up. It was really something that came around in the 70s. So, you know, for my lifetime, it's been, you know, eat low fat, high carbohydrate diets and exercise a lot and you'll be good. But it turns out for me, that's not how it works. You know, so I went ahead and I cut out most of my carbohydrates. I do eat some fruits and vegetables, but I don't. There's a lot of things that I used to eat a lot of that I don't eat. I eat pasta, bread, cereal, rice, beans, corn, peas, all kinds of stuff that I don't eat because it all has, you know, too much sugar in it. And what I found was, you know, when Scott and I were doing calorie restriction, I was still doing high carbohydrate, and I was actually able to lose a decent amount of weight, you know, 2 pounds a week, which is what they say is the sort of the most you can really expect. But I was doing it by eating 1,000 less carbohydrates than my body said I needed. So almost right away, I was hungry and was hungry all the time. And I said to myself, there's just no way I'm going to be able to do this for the rest of my life. Right. So I made this change. And immediately what I found out was the thing that I used to consider hunger is probably insulin crash. Right. So now I eat a lot of meat and fish. I really only take a couple of supplements. I do vitamin D. I do omega-3s because I don't eat nearly enough fish because I'm not a huge fish person. That's pretty much it. And, you know, on some weeks I'll lose 5-6 pounds and I'm not counting calories. I'm not really paying close attention to, you know, how much I eat. I eat until I'm satisfied and then I stop. I could skip meals and not even notice it because, you know, you're not all hungry all the time. And so since I started in April through today, I've lost almost 100 pounds. And the vast majority of that has been since September. Like 65 of it has been since September.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. Some of that sounds like, you know, there's overlaps with the kind of other low-carb diets out there. Does that?
You know, the one most people know about is Atkins, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Atkins has a couple of different phases. And during induction, which is when you start, they basically tell you don't eat any carbs at all. Just, you know, just eat fats and proteins. And that's essentially what I did when I started too.
Now, doesn't Atkins try to force you kind of into ketosis?
Yeah, yeah. Ketosis is sort of the medical condition when that generally happens when you're consuming less than 50 grams of carbohydrates a day, which actually, for the most part, I consume less than 50 carbohydrates a day, usually. And, you know, most of the only carbs I get are, you know, I eat some green vegetables, I eat some tomatoes from time to time, I eat an apple or two, but I'm not eating a lot of carbohydrates. And so ketosis is this condition where your liver is generating ketones. And it's sort of an indication that you're in very low carbohydrate mode. And so people who are worried about, I don't want to eat carbohydrates because you do need sugar in your blood, right? You do need blood sugar in order to function. Ketosis is what happens when your liver kicks in and says, I don't see enough blood sugar. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you ketone. It's a way for your liver to turn fat into sugar. And it does it just enough so that your body gets enough blood sugar for you to survive. And so it's, you know, some people have heard ketosis is very dangerous. It's actually not dangerous. There's two different conditions. There's ketosis, there's ketoacidosis. It's really the latter that you have to be worried about, which is not related to this low carb stuff. Being in ketosis is completely fine and normal. You know, I don't want to go back to the whole eat like a caveman, but you know, our ancestors lived primarily on meat. You know, fruits and vegetables were sort of rare treats. They're very seasonal. The reason that, you know, fruits are available, tend to be available in the fall. The sugar tends to fatten you up. I mean, that sort of cycle happened for us because, you know, food was going to be hard to come by in the winter. So you kind of fatten yourself up for the winter and then you lean yourself out because you don't have any of that sweet stuff anymore. So
actually, that's interesting. I may have to read up more on this primal diet because one of the things that, long story short, my background, a BS degree is in biochem, so I ended up studying some of these metabolic reactions. One of the interesting things that I found out during the course of my degree was that the standard kind of American diet in terms of combination of sugary drink with fatty food was really bad in terms of weight gain, simply because the intake of the sugary food, like the soda pop or the sweet tea or whatever, causes an insulin spike. And one of the actions of insulin is to increase the consumption of blood sugar, breaking down of the glucose in the bloodstream, and to increase the storage of fat and the creation of fatty acids and the storage of those in the fat cells. So while the fats by themselves aren't necessarily bad, when you combine them with a sugary drink first, you get this insulin spike, which then means that all the fat that you're taking into the burger, the steak, or the whatever, the french fries, instead of getting, you know, kind of evening out and getting burned at some point, it's just being stored. So,
yeah, absolutely. And actually what you find is that, you know, fat is actually a necessary thing for us. You need fat in your brain. Cellular walls are built of fat. I mean, fat is actually a pretty critical thing for your body to have. So,
oh yeah. Anyone who's had kids knows that the first thing the pediatrician tells you is, you know, give them whole milk and it's better for their brain. Just, you know, cram as much fat as you can in them.
Mm-hmm. Because they just
burn it down. They convert it straight to brain energy. And as they get to be two, they convert it into mischievous energy just almost immediately.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of skim milk at all. In fact, that, you know, most adults probably shouldn't be drinking milk. You know, a lot of adults are actually probably lactose intolerant, but you know, if you're going to give a kid milk, absolutely give them whole milk. Don't give them skim milk.
Cool. Well, we should probably wrap up. Was there anything big that we missed that you wanted to talk about?
We got NBC plugged. We got Axiom plugged.
Awesome.
I think we're good.
Okay.
Are you going to give your 51st presentation here soon?
You know, I'm actually over 50. So, as you know, I just rolled right past it.
Well, I know of one place you're presenting at soon, which is MVC Conf.
Oh, yeah, we could pimp that. I don't know when this episode's going to come out.
Yeah, hopefully before
then. That's like double pimping.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is a double pimp, yeah.
Yeah, it's a race, huh? I don't know. So MVC Conf is on February 8th, but if it's not before then, all the episodes are available on demand after that. So, so do you have anything else coming up that you're speaking at that you want to talk about or any other pimping?
Actually, you know, it seems like it's going to be a pretty quiet year for me. I don't have any big things planned. I'm not going to TechEd or PDC that I know of. And of course, you know, MVP Summit is, you know, not for most people, so they don't really care.
Didn't you do a really good presentation at the PMP Summit?
And was it really good? I don't know. It was. I thought it was all right. It was, you know, what's new in MVC 3, kind of a whirlwind. And I just did the .NET Developers Association here in Redmond, which is kind of an intro to with some focus on the MVC 3 features. But Brian Henderson taped it. I'm hoping it came out all right. Maybe we can get it up on the web.
Cool. Okay. Well, I guess that's it then. Thanks a bunch for being on the show.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
Great. Okay. And we'll catch you, and by you, I mean our listeners. We will catch our listeners soon on another episode of Herding.